Good afternoon. Welcome to our One Book, One College event entitled Visions of Tomorrow, Science Fiction as Social Commentary. Thank you for being here. My name is Erica Deiters. I've been teaching here for about 20 years, composition, creative writing, and some of the literature classes. I am not, by all means, an expert in science fiction. However, my students and I used the book last semester, and I'm looking forward to a discussion about science fiction and some of these topics that came up in our class. I'd like all of our experts, our panel members, to introduce themselves, please.
Hi, I'm Carrie Millsap Spears. I teach composition and literature, and I am a big science fiction fan.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is Andrew Roskowski. I'm a relatively new adjunct faculty member here. I teach Comm 102 primarily, and I'm also finishing up my PhD at the University of Wisconsin, where I study American poetry primarily, and also a huge science fiction fan.
Hello, that's better. Hi, I'm Tish Hayes. I'm a librarian here, and I too am a huge science fiction fan, and the only person who is not a comm teacher, but I'm a big reader.
Hi, I'm Christina Christner, also a new adjunct faculty member here at Moraine. It's my second semester. I'm teaching Comm 102 this semester. And I wrote my graduate thesis on concepts of science fiction. I'm a huge fan, scholar as well.
Good. Thank you. Good. All right. So we are going to start, please, with a definition or description. What are some of the common characteristics to the sci-fi genre? And I'm sure all of you have some answers. Whoever would like to jump in.
I'll start.
Thanks, Christina.
So I often have the debate with people about science fiction and fantasy and what separates the two. I studied a lot of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, which are arguably the creators of the genre science fiction. And both were scientists. H.G. Wells a little less so than Verne, but they both kind of created this idea of extrapolating current science and kind of predicting what might happen in the future with the way trends were going and what was developed. So for me, one of the defining characteristics for science fiction is this ability to use real science and then just kind of imagine what comes next. Anyone else?
I would say that is definitely part of many definitions of science fiction, but there are many definitions of science fiction because it's multi and interdisciplinary. It spans very different areas in the humanities. I come from more of a popular culture angle when I talk about science fiction, but I have degrees in British literature and creative writing, and one of the things I can say is that the very famous science fiction author Brian Aldiss said that science fiction comes from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is from the Gothic tradition. Now, the Gothic tradition has male and female sort of strains, and I think to kind of add to your point, the male Gothic tradition would be more of what I would argue fantasy, and the female Gothic would be more what I would argue as explained supernatural or science fiction. So the idea of adding real science to science fiction comes from that strain of the Gothic. And I have a slide on there, we'll get to that in a second. If you wanna look, you know, this is a very classic, you can click it. It's a very classic mashup. It's either Star Wars or Star Trek. One would be more fantasy and one would be more traditional explained supernatural. And I think that is one area where they differ.
So I don't know if you want to go back. So to Star Trek is the more grounded in science or fantasy?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not the expert at all. and you want me to go back?
Yeah, you can go back.
Are there additions to this, other common characteristics that you note as you read science fiction?
Andrew, yeah, sure. I'll jump in here. Yeah. I think In addition to what's already been mentioned, I see a strong sort of theme of adventurism in science fiction, especially in the sort of mid-20th century works, such as, you know, works by Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and those kinds of writers. So yeah, absolutely, in addition to being scientifically based, oftentimes, in fact, written by scientists themselves, I do see that coupled with a strong sense of adventurism in terms of space travel, et cetera.
Do you think that it feels like adventurism to us because we don't get to do it, right? I mean, is that what you're saying? Like, here, travel into space, for example, hasn't happened yet. So that's why it seems adventurous. Is it adventurous in the text itself? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, I think adventurous in terms of, you know, venturing into what is not known.
Okay.
To us currently, and to the even the characters themselves in these works. I guess formally speaking, in some of the more contemporary science fiction works I'm familiar with, I can see that definition working for the form of the writing itself as well.
How about, I like the example Star Trek, Star Wars. Are there additional examples? I mean, obviously Asimov is our one book this year. Are there examples that can help us understand this concept of grounded in science or even adventurism or any of the other characteristics you guys mentioned? Are there additional examples there from this book or other books that you've read? So again, concrete to help illustrate.
I have a list.
You have a list. She has a list.
Go ahead. So, I would say that the idea of adventure novels also, Fred Botting, a Gothic scholar, would also say that adventure novels come out of the scope of the Gothic. Aldous's book here that I have with me called A Trillion Year Spree, he really talks about how this is no longer one genre. These are many genres kind of caught in this sort of perpetual loop. So the discussion of, you know, being grounded in reality. So one of the things, I am a big Star Trek fan. All my students know this, spoiler alert. But the idea that Star Trek actually is grounded in science in some ways. And on the slide, there's a quote from the creator of Star Trek and how he wanted it to seem real. People to understand that these are real people, they're just in a different time, rather than just futuristic, you know, it's a galaxy far away, so that we wouldn't know what's going on, so we would have this sort of, try to figure out and have suspend disbelief. But what I would say far as, like, shows, if you're into television, Battlestar Galactica, the reboot of that is very much something that is adventure. It's also escape, it's also danger, it's also all of those things. There's another slide where we have a whole bunch of lists of different shows, but if you're interested in books that are kind of interesting, The Ship Who Sang by Anne McCafferty talks about disability and ability in space. Kindred by Octavia Butler is time travel, talking about the American Civil War and slavery. Changing Planes by Ursula Le Guin talks about food and how we're pretty much all made of corn at this point. So, I mean, you name it, it's out there. It's out there. So I don't know if that went off into a wrong tangent, but it's definitely something to consider.
Are there additional examples that anybody wants to share? Or again, references to the text at hand?
I mean, I can think of a lot. Yeah, we could just stand here and come up with lots of examples, but I think specifically kind of tying into Asimov and this idea of science and extrapolating our concerns about, like, what's going on with science, like the two TV series that I think of are Black Mirror, so very grounded in, like, politics of the time and social issues of the time, but also, like, some really practical science that you could see, like, why the writers chose to extrapolate in those particular ways. And then Westworld, which is another, like, very concerned about robots and AI, but also the ethical concern. So there's this extrapolation and world building that is around the science, but also very much grounded in like reality and like what ethical situations we're dealing with now.
Any other additions?
Okay. Yeah, I can think of Neal Stephenson, particularly the book Seven Eves, which deals with concerns of ethics as well, and evolution. And of course, I do think there's this sense of adventurism present in that book as well. Another writer that does come to mind would be China Mieville, although I think he kind of straddles both sci-fi and fantasy.
Okay.
He's often classified as his writing is classified as weird fiction frequently, and I see elements of both sci-fi and fantasy present in some of his works, like Perdido Street Station.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of chime in with the whole Westworld with that as well. I think that's a really good tie-in with Asimov and iRobot and artificial intelligence, which my classes worked on a project last semester. And there was a good discussion about AI and artificial intelligence and where that's kind of leading. And I think that's, we talk about these different subtopics with, you know, sci-fi and where it's branching off into different almost individual genres. And I think that's a good example. That's like one whole genre right there with the artificial intelligence and the dangers present with that or the benefits. So that was something that I think was a good tie-in with Asimov, as well as just I see the picture of the Will Smith iRobot, yep. Which my classes, I actually had them watch. That is a good example of a take on the story, but it's not really true to the text.
Okay. So again, seeing the actual real science at hand, but we're also kind of falling into the bigger part of our topic today, which are some of the concerns or the social commentary of some of these texts. So you've given us some quick examples, but what are some of the predictions made in some of these sci-fi texts? What are some of the concerns brought up? My students and I, again, we talked about this text last summer or last fall, and it wasn't about robots. Like, we kept saying that, well, it's about robots. I don't like robots. I don't want to talk about robots. I'm like, but in the end, it's not really about robots. It's about mm-hmm. us. It's about what Asimov is saying about us. Mm-hmm. So what are, again, a little more in depth, if you will, some of those predictions or some of those concerns? What are these sci-fi writers saying to us? About some of these social problems, or how are they reflected in these texts? It's a big question, I apologize.
Well, I can start with that a little bit. Okay. Science fiction is never about robots or weird planets or aliens or whatever, even though if you like those things, it can be. But it's always about the human condition. It's the human condition in space. It's the human condition in, you know, a new time or whatever. And it's done on purpose, and it started, you know, with the old versions of science fiction, like Asimov and some of the ones before, because they couldn't get past the censors of some things. So Star Trek, for example, began in 1966 and wanted to explore different things on television, and the censors would not let them do it. So they kept changing the plots to make it so that they could talk about it. So they had these really deep allegories going on. So it was never about just the ship going to a different planet. It was always about Earth. So when they had the first interracial kiss on television, it happened in space, but also in a sort of an alternate reality in space, because that's the only way they could get it to go on television. Now, it didn't make it so that everyone got to see it, however, because half the country didn't see it because the television station refused to air it. So if you think about it, when you really kind of put it into a social context, science fiction has been pushing the boundaries of all of these discussions of race, diversity, you know, class structures. It's been doing that from the beginning, and that's part of its design, because it was the way that people could talk about things that they couldn't talk about it before. We think everything is like this hidden meaning or something, and they weren't trying to hide it. they were just trying to get it past a certain level of censor so they could express their situation. Now everything's out into the open, and so we think, well, why do we have to make it a robot? Why can't we just make it a person? Well, some people like to kind of think about things through a metaphor or through an extended allegory, and I think that's why science fiction is popular, why it remains popular. And, you know, some people say if something's popular, then it must not be good. Well, as a pop culture person, I would say that's not true. So that's just my two cents.
What are other findings on your part regarding or discoveries regarding social concerns?
I actually kind of wanted to play off what she was saying about the how everything's like kind of now becoming reality. A lot of these concepts, you know, are becoming real, especially with like AI and things like Alexa and Siri, and how we're almost moving from like science fiction to science fact. And it's kind of becoming more relevant, but at the same time, you know, is it still representing the same themes and ideas and concerns? So I think it's, in one way, we live in a really interesting time because a lot of what these early writers forecasted is coming true. So now we're looking at, okay, so what's next? So now what's gonna happen? So I think it's creating a greater challenge to create something that's truly science fiction because we're living in this world where all of these things are now reality and it's no longer fiction. So I think that is kind of helping to evolve the genre as well. And is it still applicable? Is it still showcasing some of these social concerns? I think so, because now our society is just interwoven with all this technology and all this what used to be science fiction concepts. So I think we're kind of almost getting to the point where we're sort of blurring the line a little bit.
I just wanted to add to that the idea that it's sort of a circular situation. So science fiction fans are now the people who are creating the technology. So they're making the technology look like the things that they love. So if you go home and you have Alexa, go home and say, Alexa, red alert. And it will create the Star Trek red alert signal. Do it. It's true. 100%. So it is partly, you know, it's hard to say which came first, the chicken or the egg, in that kind of situation. The tools that and the tech that was on one of the series, you know, they had a thing called a pad, a PADD. Guess what it looks like? It looks like an iPad. The communicator, the flip phone, was actually the old school cell phones were built to mimic those. And they're coming back, right? That new Razor's coming back. I really want that. So there's something to, you know, you kind of have to really kind of think about these things as recursive. You know, where do the ideas start and where do they end? And I think it's hard to say that one fed the other and what science fact is probably much different. You know, I think a lot of scientists would say tons of stuff in science fiction isn't real, but it speaks to their interests, and that's what makes it real. So I gave a presentation recently where I met a bunch of scientists, and they dig science fiction, but they know it's not real, so.
Well, and just a small point to kind of go off of that. I know that, again, the author I mentioned previously, Neal Stephenson, works as a futurist and consults with, I believe, Elon Musk's company. So several of these science fiction authors do, in fact, have their hand in the actual creation of these new technologies that we're seeing.
I think one of the things that I really love about iRobot specifically is that, like, when we were reading, like, we knew that we wanted to talk about artificial intelligence and when we were planning on this one book, One College, but really kind of trying to find a book that spoke to a wide range of themes was tough to find because things are very specialized right now in sci-fi. Like, you have very particular, ideas being conveyed. And what I thought is extraordinary about Asimov is that he really touches on all of these issues that, you know, people were concerned with in the 50s about people's relationships with each other, the nature of work, and what our meaning is in the world. And those are still the concerns we have around AI. And so that intention, although our AI and our technology looks really, I think it's so much more advanced now. We are so much closer to where, you know, what he is describing, but our fears and concerns stay the same. And I think, you know, reading Frankenstein, same thing. Like, it's amazing how deeply that book resonates still, and how writers are using that content to continue to explore the things that we've got going on in our society today.
One thing I did want to point out with Frankenstein, the one interesting note, I was thinking about it before this, one interesting note with that is Shelley pretty much deliberately glosses over the actual mechanism of bringing the monster to life. And I think that's one area why I would personally never consider Frankenstein to really be science fiction, mainly for that fact. She sort of just deliberately was like, okay, there was this process, and then, oh, the monster came to life. She doesn't really go into it. It's not about the tech. It's not about the process. It's more about it's more about Frankenstein's mentality, the conditions that created the situation, and then the rest of it is a lot about the monster finding his place in the world, and, you know, discussing issues of what makes us human. So I think it's a lot more about the social aspects. And it's not really, to me, it's not about the science. It's not about the way the monster was brought to life. Even though it's a huge, if you go on the internet, it's like a huge debate on how the monster was actually brought to life. But that, to me, is not the point of her story. And therefore, I would normally exclude Frankenstein from, like, the science fiction canon, at least for me.
So again, you're saying that true sci-fi, again, is grounded in the science itself, mm-hmm. and it's commentary about science and impact on people in society. Science itself.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much everything written is some sort of commentary on life and on the human condition. Right. And I think what defines the genre are its key aspects. And for me, science fiction's key aspects are the science. You know, otherwise it would just be fiction. So, you know, for me, I think it's a pretty clear kind of distinction, you know, that there is this scientific element. It is a large portion of the story. And again, like I said, for me, if you've read Frankenstein, that the technology thing is not a large portion of the story. So it's more about his mentality at the time that he's creating the monster, and then what happens after.
Do you think that that's partly because of the author herself, too? I mean, again, maybe she had different intentions and she wasn't mm-hmm. thinking of it as scientific and predicting science, but it's yeah. Mary Shelley. Right?
Yeah.
And a young author, and mm-hmm. did she study much science? I don't know her background.
Right.
So I do.
You're good, yeah. Can you add to that?
Yes. I have a degree in British literature, and I can say that the difference between technology and the explained supernatural is the materials, right? So they had ideas, you know, before we have the technology, right? So like microphones, like screens, like all the things. So Shelley did study science. She watched people get electrocuted to see if they would come back to life. It was the science of their day. In the novel, Victor Frankenstein goes to college to study science, but sort of like science you're not supposed to study, like alchemy and things that are problematic. But she doesn't talk so much about the technology because they didn't have the terminology for those things. But the idea that this was going on was very clear to her readers if you put it into the context. I'm not a big bio critic, so I wouldn't say because she saw that, then therefore this is what was. But I do think that's one text that does allow for a lot of that kind of criticism, because she did see those things and she was aware of those things, and she was a brainiac like no other for her time. So I would really take issue with the fact that it's not a science fiction novel, but you know, that because I come from the field of the Gothic, and that's what we do. And so that's a different discipline, a different sensibility. And so, you know, everyone has differing opinions, and that's why science fiction is not one genre. It's multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary.
And that's the beauty of a panel like this, too. I mean, that's one of the reasons we bring our students in the college, these panels, is so we can hear these varying opinions, interpretations, and we appreciate that. How about Asimov? What do we know about Asimov as a writer, as his his background in science, if any.
I put his quote on there.
Good, yeah. Thank you. Good. Science fiction writers foresee the inevitable, and although problems and catastrophes may be inevitable, solutions are not. Do we know anything about him? I don't know much. Was he a scientist?
He was not a scientist.
Not a scientist. That's what I thought, right?
He's very much a writer. I don't actually know that much about Asimov either. I just, there's a Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, so if you are interested in science fiction and you want to know about terminology or books, it's online, it's open access, it's amazing. And so I was just kind of doing some cursory like review before the panel. And it's, I mean, I think it's fascinating that like these stories that make up iRobot were written in the first one was written, I think, in, sorry, like 42. Mm-hmm. So he's really young. Like he is, it says here, barely out of his teens. So he's writing these stories very young. At the time, like there isn't a big market for a novel or like a collection of short stories like this. So they're being published in pulp magazines, and what becomes iRobot is a collection of stories. And like the robot series becomes one of his masterpieces along with a few other things. That's my knowledge of his early years.
And I think what's interesting, when we were reading this last semester, we had to keep reminding ourselves, when did he write this? You know, this was published in 1950, but the story's earlier than that. His future is 1986, 1990-something, 2015, and we're like, so that's already our past, but it was his future, and so the discussion and the reading became interesting and tricky, even, for that matter.
Well, I just know he turned 100, and any time a famous author, you know, has an anniversary like that, it becomes really relevant in sort of like a popular culture sort of angle. So when someone has a birthday or something, so last year Batman turned 80, for example, so that was a thing, and Wonder Woman's going to turn 75. And so when they hit about, you know, kind of a big number, they become relevant, quote unquote, again, even if they have fallen out of favor. So it's probably why you're seeing a lot of Asimov right now, because of his, 100th birthday. I would also say that he was actually, it's kind of funny, I did a lot of research on Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, this summer. I produced two essays from the Popular Culture Research Symposium that I attended at Bowling Green State University. And what I could say is that I found out that Asimov was writing letters to Gene Roddenberry saying stuff, you know, talking smack about Star Trek, and then he started writing him back. And they had this huge correspondence. And so I read their letters, and it was quite interesting to kind of see how these two writers would argue about really silly things. And then they became quite close, and they became friends. And Asimov actually influenced that show. And so if you know anything about it, that show is still on the air. It's been going since is 54 years. Brand new series just premiered on Thursday. It's still going. And so his actual view of the future, his android, you know, the whole iRobot android idea of the rules is actually embedded into that text. And so that's really important.
I actually was going to refer to those rules right out of the book. This is the three rules regarding robots and their creation and their function are reiterated in, I think, every story within the collection. That's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. It says, we have one, a robot may not injure a human being or, through interaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first and second laws, if you follow that. I should have had that on the slide. Have comments to those three laws or those three rules that are, again, reiterated, emphasized in each of these stories? Why do we have such rules?
Well, I think the Westworld fan should speak to that.
Okay.
That'd be Tish.
I don't have any particular thoughts related to Westworld, actually, but I'm sorry. But one of the things that was noted in this, and I guess, you know, the three rules, they've been around for a while, and I do feel like they, this idea about harm to, like, not causing harm to humans, like, they're very much keeping robots in a particular, like, status and or a particular role, right? Like, they're making sure that they are not going to come, or not going to harm us. And one of the things that was noted in the encyclopedia article that I was reading about Asimov is that those rules are not scientific rules. Like, there's no science backing that those rules up, right? Like, they're just completely made up, and they're made up as a narrative device. So that Asimov and all of us who use those rules, because those rules get used in all kinds of sci-fi scenarios, like, you can find ways around them, and what happens when one of them breaks down. So it's really this way to, like, set up a structure for thinking about, like, how we interact with robots rather than any kind of, like, scientific law that, you know, is going to get put in place, which I found really interesting and an interesting way to think about, then, of course, the way robots are functioning in these stories and why they're there.
I think the rules are very Orwellian, too. So if you've read 1984, there's a bunch of rules, you know, can't do this, but later on they change the rules, except if you have whatever. And so they kind of remind me of that.
Yeah, going along with that, I did a lot of study on utopianism and dystopianism and its themes in science fiction. And I think part of these laws kind of reflect that when you create a society, you have to have rules, you have to have laws to monitor the citizens, to, you know, control behavior, which is where things, you know, 1984 and Orwell have that idea. So I think this is an example of placing limits on something that might become self-aware or might become autonomous, and the fact that we would have to put limits on that in order to safeguard ourselves. And I think it also speaks to kind of a greater issue of self-awareness. And going back to Star Trek, which I'm also a huge fan, there is an episode involving the android Data in Star Trek The Next Generation. And he gets to this point where he's kind of questioning his existence and whether or not, like, what makes somebody human. And at one point he talks about, you know, do feelings make someone human? He was on this big quest to get feelings because he didn't have feelings. He was self-aware but didn't have emotion. So there was this big ongoing theme of, is it just things like feelings that make someone human? If a robot, and this is addressed in iRobot as well, if a robot has feelings, does that then make them human? Like, what is the essence of our humanity? And I think that's kind of one of the things that I kept seeing over and over in iRobot, was a lot of the statements the robots made, a lot of the things that they did, was because they almost had emotions. They almost had feelings. Like, some of them got offended. Some of them, you know, were worried and concerned. Those are feelings. Those are things we associate with humans. And so I think this idea of the self-aware robot, which we still haven't quite created, is a little concerning. And do we need to apply rules to something like this? Should we? And then we can go into themes of, you know, would they have rights? Should they have rights? Do we relegate them to, you know, slave labor? I had my classes last fall discuss being replaced by robots in terms of the working world. You know, should that be a concern? Is it fair if they do end up having feelings or are autonomous?
I think our class kept referring to these rules and reading them for ourselves, mm-hmm. right? It's so the robot may not injure a human being, but really, I mean, that's a great rule for us too, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. what we kept saying. I think this is commentary on how yeah. we are behaving and how we are interacting, mm-hmm. and right, we must obey orders, and again, you know, we should follow rules so we can work with the community and work with the, you know, our organizations and mm-hmm. yeah, and that we, yeah, for sure protect ourselves, but what about mm-hmm. the people around us too? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I everything, and that might have just been me, not a sci-fi person, going back to humanity and how to read this text and see what is he trying to say about us? Mm-hmm. What is this reflecting upon us and our behaviors? So something else that we picked up on too, Dr. Susan Kelvin, she's our lead scientist in the collection of stories. She's a woman scientist. And again, when he wrote those stories in the 40s, that's not necessarily typical. I mean, we're learning more and females are being emphasized more from the past, but is this another prediction on his part in the 80s and 90s and 2015s and 20s that women have a large role? What do you think? Is that a big question too? I'm sorry.
So what I think is interesting about that is that she is not given like a hard science background.
Yeah. And I feel like she added later to the story.
Oh, I think she was that art overarching story where she's narrating kind of. Right. Yes. But she was definitely still in the stories themselves. So she can be there as a scientist, but she's really like a psychiatrist of robotics. True. So she doesn't get the hard science. She also is described in the first page as a frosty girl.
Yeah.
which is telling, I think, of the time. So she is a single older woman who does not get to, who acts very emotionless, prefers robots. But there's a story in the collection where she like is given the opportunity to have a crush on someone, and she becomes ridiculous, and kind of, he portrays her as pretty pitiful. And wow, I feel like that whole like series of things tells you maybe like how Asimov himself or maybe the larger society thought about women in the 50s. And so I feel like you could take some good things, like at least there is a woman represented, because there's sometimes no women are represented, but it makes me very uncomfortable and a little like frustrated, like, oh, like I'm glad that we can talk about that, right? Like that we are at a different place and we can, the social commentary that's happening in iRobot is not just what Asimov intended, it's also picking up on all of the things that that he's writing from his own biases.
In the 40s and the 50s and the attitudes and of the time. So they're still reflected, even though he's seeing what could be, he can't predict the growth or the treatment or the equality or regulations or whatever.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that in like the only other person of this time that I've read a lot of is Ray Bradbury. Mm-hmm. And I love Ray Bradbury, but he also is incredibly sexist. Mm-hmm. Like when you read his stuff, it's amazing. He's clearly making an effort to make some commentary about race in a lot of his sci-fi that seems progressive for the time, but his sexism is so blatant. And it's tough because like I love it. Like his writing's great. Like it's so intriguing to me, but also you have to read it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, another one if you want more cringeworthy from that era. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. The one protagonist has he's a male, has three female assistants, and he literally has a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead as his three assistants. And it's just, it's so sexist. Like, I almost couldn't get through the book. It's so incredibly sexist. But again, from that same era and another male writer.
So I found Asimov's writing to be a little bit dry. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of imagery, not a lot of description. Again, the topics were amazing, the AI topics, the commentary on humanity and our behaviors. But the writing itself, the descriptions, seemed to be lacking. The scenes seemed to be lacking. It was really driven by dialogue. I'm wondering, is that typical of the era, too? That's not oversweeping, obviously, of all sci-fi, but this is more period. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, I definitely, researching my thesis, definitely saw that, especially in Stranger in a Strange Land. There's a whole lot of dialogue. And I think it's a fair generalization to make that there is a lot of dialogue. But I think in particular with iRobot, probably because it was done in separate pieces and published in like a magazine, I think that appeals to a wider audience. Because I know, and this is kind of a bad example, but I used to work with somebody who, when I was talking about my thesis and talking about science fiction and Star Trek and Star Wars, you know, she actually said to me that she doesn't like anything in the fantasy sci-fi genre because she can't understand it. And it's kind of this idea of making it accessible. And for some people, just, you know, even just imagining things, even if it's described to them, you know, for some people, it's maybe too far of a reach.
To cross that line,
yeah,
or the,
yeah, and they just can't.
Suspension of disbelief, as you mentioned.
Well, I think that's the issue with genre fiction in general. You know, they tend to be very dialogue and plot driven, you know, so if you're going to, you know, parse out what's literary, quote unquote, fiction and what's quote unquote genre fiction, that would be one area where they definitely differ. I think it really depends on the writing and the writer and, you know, what you find interesting. But if you pick up like current, you know, science fiction, like fan novels written, you know, Star Wars, you know, universe novels or whatever, they're going to be dialogue driven because they don't have to build the world. The world is already built. So everyone already knows. If you're already a fan of the thing, you don't have to spend time building that world. And I think the other side of it is people get lost in world building. So like if you read The Lord of the Rings, there's a lot of description of trees and they sing and dance in the forest and then they have dinner, you know, and they have to spend a lot of time building that world, you know. Tolkien has to build that world so we understand it. And so I think it can go both ways in that.
Are there any other greater themes, or again, since this is called Visions of Tomorrow, science fiction is social commentary, are there any other commentaries that you think are worth sharing with the group here today, either from Asimov or otherwise? Big themes, topics?
Sure, yeah. Well, as with all science fiction, most science fiction, I guess I should say, it's, of course, you know, culturally, socially contingent in many, many ways. And so just one major theme I see in a lot of current speculative fiction and sci-fi is, of course, climate change. And so that's a huge concern. And it's one thing that much of what contemporary sci-fi, again, speculative writers are concerned with. And so I think that is another, you know, major defining aspect of the genre.
What are they predicting?
Disaster. Complete disaster. Mostly.
Thanks for that. Anything else? Other topics?
Themes? I would say the topic of refugees is being explored in the new series Picard. And I think it's going to be the pivotal imagery in that series from everything that I've read. That series starts with a robot rebellion of sorts, and then that doesn't allow refugees to come to Earth. And I think that's a huge metaphor for what's going on in our current climate. You know, so I think that that's going to be explored even more. I think you're going to see that even more. And I think that some people don't like science fiction because at the end it becomes kind of dark and apocalyptic. I think you have to kind of consider what type of science fiction you're interested in, because many stories can end that way. There are some that are kind of optimistic, and some people would say that they're too optimistic, but you know, they don't all end, you know, in epic disaster. So if you're a fan of like Battlestar Galactica, for example, I won't give it away if you've never seen it, but it doesn't end in apocalyptic disaster. And so that could be pleasant. Maybe, but you have to go through 5 seasons. So right.
Yeah, and kind of jumping off that, they're not all completely disaster. Although I did take a course on utopias and dystopias, and of the dozen or so books we read, there was only one single utopian vision, I would say, especially in contemporary writing, right. And that was Kim Stanley Robinson's Pacific Edge, which is focused on the sort of, you know, fallout of massive climate change, although it is a more utopian vision of the future. Well, so they exist.
Well, I would argue that disaster sells. And so when we're writing stories and films and books and things, we're trying to build audiences, we kind of want those explosions. So, you know, the happily ever after is kind of built into the romance genre. So, you know, if you kind of put it that way, you know, they're almost, if you're going to play the roulette wheel, they're probably going to end disastrously because you get more special effects.
So I definitely agree that like climate change, I think, is maybe the number one theme that I see in sci-fi today, in technology. But there's also so many others. So if those are not things that are of a particular interest to you, there's other things that you can seek out. I think, so every year I go to this conference / convention called WizCon, and it was founded as a feminist science fiction convention, and it has evolved into a bigger thing. And every year there's so many people there talking about like queer identities, different racial and ethnic identities, disability and abilities. And so, and then there's all kinds of scientists that are there talking about like how biology is popping up, or like physics is popping up in like these different shows, books, all kinds of things. And so I think like there's just so much room out there to explore the concerns that we have as people moving through the world. And I really like your point, like because sci-fi is very culturally bound, it is, I think, incredible to start reading outside of the American genre. So like if you're reading, there's some really good Nigerian science fiction that I've read recently that, I don't know, kind of blows your mind, like, because they're pulling on different ideas and mythologies and different things to, and different concerns and different perspectives. So all of that, to me, is what makes sci-fi super exciting.
Yeah, there's some interesting Chinese literature, sci-fi, as well.
We have a couple minutes left. Do we have questions, maybe, from the audience to our panel? Do you have questions about sci-fi? Do you have questions about some of the commentaries out there or predictions? Anybody? I guess my last question might be, if you have a highly recommended, like a favorite author, favorite books of sci-fi, if you can. I know favorites are really, really hard. But maybe for the audience, those who might be interested, something specific. Title, author?
American Gods by Neil Gaiman.
Are you taking notes?
I have my list if you want it.
Are they up here?
No, I didn't put them up there.
For me, what really got me into the genre, again, H.G. Wells, one of my favorites is The Time Machine. And it's actually a shorter one, too. It's like 80 pages. Also, Jules Verne, which was kind of his counterpart, and which reminds me of when you were talking about Gene Roddenberry and Asimov, because H.G. Wells and Verne were contemporaries, and they actually went back and forth as well, writing each other letters. It was a little more heated. Verne basically thought Wells didn't know what he was talking about. But also, you know, Journey to the Center of the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, also a favorite. So, also War of the Worlds. And I am not ashamed to admit, but that is one of the few novels. There was a part in that book that actually brought me to tears for the original War of the Worlds. So I also highly recommend that,
that
as well.
That is good writing.
Yeah.
I have a lot, but I will just mention Ursula K. Le Guin and Octavia Butler are my two like all-time favorites. And if you read everything that they've written, your life will be a better life. Also, if you really enjoyed the themes of Asimov's iRobot and maybe weren't super excited about the like writing, I will recommend a new collection by Ted Chiang called Exhalation. So a lot of the same themes, but he's just like a much more fun writer and is writing from a contemporary perspective.
Yeah, sure. I'll throw out a couple here. So a bit older work would be Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke. That's a big favorite of mine. Really anything by Bradbury, I'm a big fan as well. I've already mentioned, you know, Neal Stephenson, Seven Eves. That's a wonderful book, I think. But also I'll throw out Margaret Atwood.
Yeah.
Oryx and Crake, yeah. Particularly, but also the whole Mad Atom trilogy. So those are some favorites.
Good, thank you. Thank you, Carrie and Andrew and Tish and Tina. Thank you for your time and your expertise. And thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.